From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In 1971, a handful of young men created the organization known as Greenpeace. One of the founders, a man named Bob Hunter, wanted to create an ecology movement on the same scale as the civil rights movement or the peace movement. But the question was, how do you take hold of the global mind? How do you get people's attention? And then, where do you start? Filmmaker Jerry Rothwell's new documentary, which is premiering at the Sundance Film Festival this year, documents the early days of Greenpeace and the tension between principle and compromise that always seems to come to groups with passionate leaders and high stakes. We recorded a conversation with Rothwell last night about his film. It's called How to Change the World. You'll hear it after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Greenpeace is not the largest environmental organization in the world, but it's pretty big. 41 national offices all over the world, nearly 3 million members. You could say it's powerful, influential. But if you trace it back to the fall of 1971, you can find its beginnings. A handful of eccentric and energized young men on a rusty fishing ship motoring for the Aleutian Islands. Jerry Rothwell tells this story in his new documentary. It was the group's first direct action to somehow try and stop an underground nuclear test on a remote island off the coast of Alaska. And this was one of those moments that really marked the beginning of the modern environmental movement, because the effort captured the attention of the world, which is exactly what these young men were going for. But Rothwell says they found themselves like a band with an unexpected hit song that had catapulted them to fame, and success tested them. It pulled them apart at times. It threatened to undo the work they had started. Today in the program, we're beginning our coverage of the Sundance Film Festival with Jerry Rothwell's documentary. It's called How to Change the World. We're here at the Alf Engen Ski Museum at the Utah Olympic Park, and we have an audience with us. Jerry Rothwell is a documentary filmmaker who has produced a number of feature-length pieces. His films Donor Unknown, about a sperm donor and his offspring, and Deep Water, about an ill-fated round-the-world yacht race, both aired as part of the PBS series Independent Lens. He is the director, as I said, of How to Change the World, which premieres tomorrow night here at the festival. It's the opening night world documentary, and we'll give you more details about that a little bit later in the program. Jerry Rothwell, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Doug. It's great to be here.
Well, I wanted to, begin with something that I read that you had talked about. One of the things that drew you to this particular film was that you're interested in some way about the story of all nascent groups that how they get their beginnings, I guess. What's the thing that interests you about that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I spent various stages of my life being part of groups that try to organize themselves collectively, try to organize themselves in a kind of non-hierarchical way. And I guess with Greenpeace, it was a classic situation where a group comes together because of a sort of common vision. And that's the fairly easy stage. It's like kind of falling in love. And the difficult stage, as the third world song goes, is now that we've found love, what are we going to do with it?
Yeah.
And it's the stage of turning that into kind of action. And immediately you're dealing with a whole set of different people who have different ideas about what they're doing, different agendas. And I guess that process is one that I'm really interested in. And I guess that's the kind of thing that attracted me to this project.
Did it surprise you how many different portraits there were to tell, different players? There seemed to me like there were so many who could have been almost their own film in some way.
I think one of the things that I found really fascinating from the beginning was that Greenpeace had managed to encompass, people who now had such different attitudes to kind of environmental politics, people who were advising kind of multinationals on green PR, and people who were still kind of ramming Japanese whalers in the South Atlantic. You know, right. So the fact that at one point that group could encompass people who became so differently aligned was something I found really interesting.
We have to talk about the archive footage in the film. I think this has to be some of the most detailed, extensive footage I've seen in a documentary. It's really amazing.
Yeah, I mean, the way we found a lot of that footage was I was doing a project that took me into the Greenpeace archive to look at its more modern footage, video footage, and kind of realized as part of that process that there were these 1,500 silver 16mm cans sitting in storage, which hadn't really been opened for 40 years because at the time they'd been shot on board the boats in the early Greenpeace campaigns. They'd been made into campaigning films about whales or about seals, but they hadn't really been explored for their potential to kind of look inward in a way, you know, to look at the characters involved and look at what was motivating them. And, you know, unlike video, where you can sit down and just kind of watch it, it's that tempting thing of not knowing what's on the cans, I think. So gradually we kind of started to look at that material.
I mean, 1,500 cans, which I guess to me it kind of reveals, and this is a point you really get at in the film, they were determined to share this experience with the world. I mean, they were shooting pretty much everything.
Yeah, I mean, they were an organization that was really prescient about media. You know, this was just at the time when mass media was emerging in the sense that you could take an image and you could network that image worldwide across the television. And I think Bob Hunter in particular realized the potential of that to make change. And they went out looking for those images. They went with very specific ideas about what those images should be. So, for example, you know, to capture a shot of a dinghy in between a harpoon gun and a whale, that's a very precise image to want to get. And then, you know, everything is organized in order to get that image.
I wonder what the interviews were like. I mean, these were men, some women, who were full of passion and energy when they were young. What did you find about, as you were looking at the, you know, the archival footage of them with, you know, these massive beards and this great hair, and, you know, they lost their hair and they may have lost a little bit of energy. I mean, how did you see that they had changed as you're talking to them when you compare the, you know, the old with the new?
Oh, I mean, there's a bit less hair there, but there's still a lot of passion. You know, for a group of kind of, you know, 60, 70, 80-year-old men, most of them are deeply involved in some way in environmentalism now and very active. So they've carried that really from the age of, you know, Paul Watson was 19 at the start of the film. So they've carried that from their sort of late teenage years.
The film has, as I said, a lot of different portraits in it, but it seems like in some way, and I wonder if you think it's also a portrait about, you know, about activism, about kind of the nature of activism, kind of as an organism almost, and how it works.
Yeah, I mean, I think Greenpeace are kind of, you know, they're a classic case study because they start as, you know, a small bunch of kind of hippies, well, actually not only hippies, but in a boat, you know, the smallest group imaginable, really. Yeah. And within 10 years, they've become an international organization with, you know, offices on four different continents and starting that with a notion, you know, Bob Hunter began with this idea of let 1,000 Greenpeace offices bloom. You know, we won't try and control it. We're trying to create a movement. Let's just get out there, enable people to set up their own Greenpeaces. And this, of course, creates a kind of problem because those local Greenpeace groups start raising money around their own campaigns. They have no reference to the center. They use the images that have been created by this small group in Vancouver, but for perhaps completely different purposes. So suddenly you face the problem of organization. And I think a lot of groups face that dilemma of at what point do we need to prioritize our organization over the movement. And I think different members of Greenpeace at that time took different positions in that, and you know, that caused a lot of conflict. But that dilemma between the organization and the movement, how do you be organized, but you also need a bottom-up, decentralized, you know, people-led movement?
Let's talk about Bob Hunter, because it's fair to say he's at the heart of the story for you. Explain who he is. as I watched the film, I got the sense that he's sort of this Hunter S. Thompson character, if Hunter S. Thompson were a tree hugger.
Yeah, I mean, so Bob Hunter was a journalist for the Vancouver Sun. At the start of the film, he's actually just about to have his 30th birthday, which is a problem in an age when everyone says, don't trust anyone over 30.
right.
And he, I guess by that time, he'd also written, you know, a couple of novels, two books. And he was very sort of prescient about the way the world was changing in the late 60s. You know, he really understood, I think, and saw this kind of cultural, huge cultural shift that was going on in the late 60s. And his particular take on it, and I think this was to do with coming from Canada and coming from Vancouver in particular, was an environmental take, you know. And he, you know, he initially joined the first Greenpeace expedition as a kind of reporter to report on this voyage to stop a nuclear test. For him, it sort of fulfilled a theory that he had in one of his books about change coming from kind of creating what he called these mind bombs,
yeah.
You know, media events which would spread very quickly around the world. But I think very quickly he realized he perhaps couldn't just be the reporter. He already was, as you say, a kind of gonzo journalist who really put himself into the journalism. But I think very quickly he started to realize he needed to become a kind of participant, and in a way he left his journalism behind for activism.
And as people will see in the film, he's a beautiful writer.
Yeah.
And his writing really tells the story of the film. I mean, we hear his words read by the actor Barry Pepper.
Yeah, I mean, one of the sort of structural problems of a film like this, you know, in terms of how do you structure it, you could structure it just around a single campaign, but I really wanted that breadth of, you know, 8 years as this group goes from the small group in the boat to the international organization, because it felt to me that's where the heart of the story was. But to do that, really, that shifts the emphasis from kind of what they're doing to their relationships with each other, because those are the things that are consistent and that are changing and developing across that time period. And Bob Hunter's voice was a really... His writing's about Greenpeace. He wrote 13 books, not all of them about Greenpeace, but they're very honest. They're not promotional books. They're incredibly self-critical, very funny, and they provided a perfect kind of tool for this sort of narration that could weave in and out of the archive and in and out of the interview.
So we mentioned sort of... We've done the, I guess, introduced this first direct action. The U.S. is planning on setting off this 5-megaton nuclear bomb underground on an island in the Aleutians. Talk about what the plan was, because it was only sort of a plan. I mean, they wanted to get there and do something.
So I think the plan came about because the sort of leader of the group that existed just before Greenpeace, Jim Bolan, was phoned up by the media, and they said, you know, this test is coming along. What are you going to do about it? And his wife had just said, well, why don't we sail a boat there? So the idea to sail a boat into the nuclear test zone and park it there. Bolan was a Quaker, was very much in the idea of bearing witness to things in the world, and he felt that by doing that, you know, they would kind of bear witness to the test. But at the time they had that idea, they had no boat. And it's very hard to get, you know, someone who owns a boat to take it into a nuclear test zone uninsured. So that was their first dilemma, I guess.
We should just say something about John Cormack, who's the captain of this rusty old fishing boat, and a terrific character himself.
Yeah, I mean, without John Cormack, there is no Greenpeace. Right. And Cormack is this fisherman who's been kind of going up and down the West Coast for, you know, 20 years, knows it intimately, is not a great fisherman by all accounts, although, and so in a sense did this first trip for the money. You know, he found a way of renting out his boat with this bunch of hippies, taking them to a nuclear test zone, and it meant he didn't have to fish for that period, and the fishing wasn't great in that season. But he ends up doing several voyages with Greenpeace. I think he becomes the kind of, you know, Greenpeace had at this time sort of heads of this, that, and the other, and he becomes, you know, the head of the Greenpeace Navy, you know. So he spent, you know, maybe the next sort of 6-7 years of his life really, you know, deeply involved in Greenpeace.
But Bob Hunter, as you said, wants to make this a real event. What's so interesting about this enterprise was that it was one of the first movements to kind of go viral in some ways, or at least this is what Bob Hunter wants. Here's a clip from the film. Now you're going to hear Rod Marining in here. He's one of the eco-freaks, long list of characters. Patrick Moore, you'll also hear. And then, of course, the words of Bob Hunter. This is read by the actor Barry Pepper.
Hey, you know what it's all about? It's putting on a good show.
People in Alaska, down the Pacific coast, Canada, and Japan have protested. The people fear earthquakes, damage to wildlife.
The theory of electronic communication was just being developed at that time. You know, the fax hadn't been invented yet. Bob coined the term mind bomb for what today we would call going viral, where an idea gets into the electronic media and just spreads like ripples on a water instantly.
Image is everything. The boat is an icon, a mind bomb sailing across an electronic sea into the front rooms of the masses.
I guess we should also say it was Bill Darnell who came up with the name Greenpeace.
That's right. Yeah, the story goes that at the end of a meeting, this is before they had the name Greenpeace, one of the older members of the group would always kind of say peace as everyone went out the door, and Darnell was one of the younger members who was more environmentally focused, and he said, let's make it a Greenpeace. They then decided to name the boat Greenpeace, and they couldn't fit the two words green and peace on a badge as separate words, so they decided to combine them.
How important was the name, do you think?
As Pat Moore says in the film, you know, it did kind of bring together two things, which was what was happening, the bringing together of a sort of the peace movement on the back of the Vietnam War and of the anti-nuclear movement with the environmental movement. And so Greenpeace represented this kind of coming together of those two sort of forces, I suppose, to sort of see connections that maybe hadn't been seen before.
Jerry Rothwell. He directed How to Change the World, part of the Sundance Film Festival's World Documentary Competition. We recorded our conversation last night in Park City. The film premieres tonight. We should mention that screening and all the others during the festival already have wait lists, but you can get all the details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're beginning our coverage of this year's Sundance Film Festival. Last night in Park City, we recorded a conversation with Jerry Rothwell about his film, which is opening the festival in the World Documentary Competition. It's about the creation of the environmental organization Greenpeace. The film is a profile of the eccentric and energized young men who kickstarted the modern environmental movement by risking their lives for the cause and using the media to win public sympathy. It's called How to Change the World. There's this moment I wanted to ask you about. So they're on their way, and for various reasons, they have to stop in this harbor, this abandoned whaling station in this little fishing village in Alaska. And John Cormack tells them, don't go ashore. But they do anyway, and they're not inclined to listen to authority anyway. And this is a really important moment. And I want to play this a scene from the film, because this seemed like a really critical time for really kind of them bonding, but also coming to a sense of what they were really about, do you think?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that they were, you know, a group on the whole of city boys, you know, and they didn't know much about nature. You know, Cormack obviously knew the sea. You know, Pat Moore had studied ecology, but on the whole, really understanding what was happening up the coast, where there are these abandoned fishing villages, where you know, particularly whaling stations, where it had been abandoned because whaling had become uneconomic, and I think it really brought something home to them.
Now, those here in the audience tonight have the advantage of being able to see some of the images. People in the radio won't get that sense, but give us a sense of what they are actually seeing.
So they land in, this is Akitan Harbor, quite far north. The beach is kind of littered with the bones of whales, you know, and these kind of huge, huge bones. And also with the sort of detritus of the whaling station, you know, rusting harpoon heads, the boilers which were used to sort of melt down the blubber of the whale. So gradually they're sort of piecing together what may have happened.
In the remains of the whaling station, huge bones thrust out of the moss like thickets. We are intent on trying to prevent a nuclear holocaust. But for this other race of giant creatures, the holocaust has already come. As though we've been given a glimpse of our own future.
We walk up into the hills where it's kind of rocky and otherworldly. I think a few people were a bit on the psychedelic side. We all sort of lay face down in this moss and immersed ourselves in nature. And we started to talk.
As Dr. Patrick gives us the ultimate lecture in ecology, in a leaping flash, we all connect with the idea that all life is interwoven. The whales, the moss, us. We are all one. A flower is your brother.
How important was that moment, do you think, for the organization?
I think making that connection between this sort of industrial destruction of nature and the place of human beings in nature was a really important thing, and perhaps something that popular culture had kind of ignored at that time. And I think for Hunter particularly, that moment was an important one.
It wasn't long before the expedition hit some snags. They had a confrontation with the Coast Guard. They hadn't cleared customs. The weather was starting to get rough. I mean, it was becoming winter. And so the question then becomes, you know, do we turn back and keep going? There's another moment here that's important. It seems to be about how you define success. And have we done enough to do what we've done and gotten close? We didn't quite get there. Should we go all the way? I mean, and Bob Hunter at this moment, he wants to go all in. Everyone else is saying, or other people are saying, no, we've done enough, let's not risk our lives. This seemed like another kind of important moment for at least Bob's thinking.
Yeah, I think going back to those groups that try and organize themselves in a kind of non-hierarchical, democratic way, those kinds of disagreements become really fundamental. And this was a kind of classic small group disagreement, which is about compromise. So for some of them, the purpose of the voyage was to raise its profile in the media, and that had happened. You know, they had 10,000 people out on the streets of Vancouver. President Nixon was talking to Trudeau. It was having a massive impact. But I think for Bob, Bob was kind of realizing really that they hadn't really completed the mind bomb, you know, that the mind bomb was parking the boat, in the nuclear test zone, following that through and let's see what's happened. I don't think Bob was on a kind of suicide mission. Others felt, you know, he was taking them to their certain death. But I think what he felt was they could go on and they should let the thing play out. So that was an argument, I think, lasted 7 days, you know, in the galley of a boat. It was pretty intense. And all the time, the photographer on the trip, Robert Kezia, was taking these fantastic photos. And he just took, you know, fantastic rolls of photographs of this argument happening, which we use in the film. And it's a very intense, intense kind of argument.
At one point, we can't say the words he used to a pin assigned to his sweater, Bob eventually, F off, basically, he says. I mean, he sort of just gives in.
Yeah, I think he kind of gets to the point where, you know, as we all do in those discussions at some point, was it, you know, I've had it, yeah.
Yeah, and the fact that the decision is made to not keep going really deflates him.
Yeah, I think for several years after that, actually, he felt a real sense of defeat. You know, he felt that what had happened was that the kind of pure purpose of the voyage had been destroyed by the kind of egos of the people on board the boat. And that really shaped what he did with Greenpeace after that. Because after that voyage, there was really a sense that they'd been relatively successful. The US cancelled its nuclear tests on the Aleutians after that. So within a few months, they realized they'd had quite a big impact. But so people kind of went back to their ordinary lives. But for Bob, I think, they'd created something which had potential. And that's where, when he kind of encountered the kind of whaling issue in a different way, he realized perhaps there was a future in this.
Here's another clip from How to Change the World.
Bob felt abject failure. He was angry. He was sad. He was beside himself that we weren't continuing. It broke his heart.
It's sickening for me to realize that a revolution can go no faster or further than people themselves. We're supposedly saving the world through our moral example. But in reality, we've spent most of our time at each other's throats, egos clashing, turning resistance into psychodrama.
So how is it that whales start to play a role? I mean, it wasn't obvious from the beginning. And this is where another great character comes into the story, Paul Spong. Tell us about that part, though, when whales enter the story. Yeah.
Paul Spong was a scientist from New Zealand who'd been invited to the Vancouver Aquarium to kind of explore the psychology of the first, I think one of the first captive orca whales in an aquarium, a whale called Skarner. And he devised this test, which was really about understanding the whale's vision. And the whale very quickly got the test. You know, it would get. You know, he would give the whale a fish. He would put down two boards, which would have two lines on them. You know, one had two lines, one had one line. And if the whale hit the two lines, it would get the fish. And he brought the lines closer and closer together. So he's trying to see how the whale's vision worked. And the whale was very good at that. Very quickly, though. He, on one day, the whale completely flipped its behavior. So it started getting the answers wrong. It went from 100% right to 100% wrong, 99% wrong. And Paul was trying to understand what was going on here, and he concluded that the whale was now experimenting with him and was trying to understand what he was doing. So. And that sort of led him to think about whales in a different way and led him to look at, what was happening, with whaling and to try and stop international whaling. He'd heard about the Greenpeace voyages to Amchitka and he approached Bob Hunter. Do you want me to go?
Well, I want to tell this story, yeah. This really kind of strange but beautiful moment. I want to play this moment from the film, but set this up for us.
So he invited Bob down to the aquarium. By that time, Paul had been sacked, actually, because he started a campaign saying that the whale wanted to be free, and that was too much for the aquarium.
right.
So they discontinued his experiment and his funding. But they allowed him back because I think Time magazine was going to take some photos of him inviting Bob Hunter down to the aquarium. And there's this moment where he invited Bob to meet Skarner and get to know her better. Bob sort of leant down on the platform, and at one point, I think Paul says this in the film, Skarner opened her mouth wide, sort of inviting Bob to put his head inside.
She takes my whole head in her jaws and holds me like a crystal goblet in a vise. I can feel her teeth making the slightest indentation at the back of my neck. Terror explodes in my chest. She could snap my head like an eggshell, but chooses not to. Suddenly, I get it. She's shown me exactly where my courage ends and my fear begins. Then, as though satisfied, she lets go and sinks away.
What was the importance of that moment, do you think?
I think for Bob, that it was the point where he kind of realized, he felt that the whale was trying to sort of tell him, I could have killed you, but I didn't. And he, you know, it was a recognition both of whale intelligence, but also of, like, I think, in a, you know, the potential of the whale as a symbol for what was happening to nature. You know, we were, you know, various countries were sending kind of industrial kind of whaling crews out, fleets out into the seas, and were, you know, harvesting 7,000 whales a year, 10,000 whales a year at the time. And, you know, it was this kind of industrial destruction of nature, very different from, you know, a small Inuit village catching a few whales a year. And I think he realized that that situation symbolized something much bigger, not just about saving whales, but about our whole attitude to nature as a kind of resource. As a resource in sort of the industrial world, and he wanted to do something about it.
How did the rest of the group react to Bob's suggestion that we're going to now save whales?
Well, I mean, at the time, you know, the group had really gone back to its sort of its kind of peacenik roots and was campaigning against French nuclear testing in the Pacific. Successfully, actually, they managed to stop French atmospheric nuclear testing. So the idea of saving whales was a completely kind of bizarre left field idea, but one that was very typical of Hunter, who kind of, I think, also realized its media potential. And I think at the same time as deciding that Greenpeace needed to focus on whales, he also had this image in his head of, you know, a couple of people in a dinghy between a harpoon gun and a whale. In other words, human beings risking their lives for an animal, which is not an image which, you know, perhaps had even existed before then.
I love the way Paul Watson puts it. He says that the real story isn't the whales being harpooned, but humans willing to risk their lives to save the whale. Like, that's the story going to get people's attention, and that's what they were about.
Yeah, and I think Hunter realized that, you know, the first stage of any kind of campaign is to pull attention into it. Then there's the question of what do you do with it. And Greenpeace were very savvy. It wasn't just about getting that image. They also lobbied the International Whaling Commission. You know, they had a target to try and get a moratorium against whaling, and they were kind of, you know, very strategic about the way they lobbied particular countries to do that. And finally, in 1982, I think they got the moratorium against whaling.
That's Jerry Rothwell. He directed the documentary that's premiering tonight. It's opening the festival's World Documentary Competition. It's called How to Change the World. Tonight's screening and all the others during the festival already have wait lists, but you can take your chances. For the details, go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with filmmaker Jerry Rothwell, recorded last night in Park City. His documentary is called How to Change the World. It's about the tumultuous early days of the environmental organization Greenpeace. It's the opening film for this year's Sundance Film Festival, which begins tonight.
So they had to learn to sail. They didn't really know much. I mean, they... how did Bob put it? They had to transform themselves from flower children to sailors or something like that.
Yeah, flower children to a gang of ecological bikers or something.
Yeah, that's what it was. That's what it was, right.
Sea-going ecological bikers. Yeah.
So they set sail to try to find these Russian whaling, Russian whaling fleet. But they didn't really know anything about how to find a Russian sailing fleet. I mean, the North Pacific is a pretty big place. So they got pretty creative. Do you want to talk about this part of the story?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's sort of two sides to this. I mean, Bob, at this stage, was a little bit older than the rest of the group. And he had become the de facto leader, which was a thing that surprised him, because he was someone who all his life had absolutely hated leaders and now suddenly had to come to terms with being the leader of the group himself. You know, one of the things he saw, I think, and exploited or developed was the idea that this group was composed of sort of mystics and mechanics. You know, that there were people who knew how to kind of operate a boat engine, and there were people who could kind of play a good song about whales. You know, and you needed both of those people on board. You know, and I think that it's very it's a very interesting idea of, you know, human management, actually, you know, that it's not just about the functional engineering role, it's also about the kind of spiritual and the musical and the artistic and the intuitive. But they started off trying to find the whales in a I guess a fairly kind of mechanical way, a sort of detective work almost. So Paul Spong had found out that the statistics of where whales were killed were held in the Bureau of International Whaling Statistics, which was in this kind of village in Norway. So he claimed that he was going to be doing some research into sperm whales, and he wanted to find out kind of where those whales were. And one of the ways of finding out where those whales were was finding out where they were killed. He explained his scientific credentials, which he did have. He didn't, as Pat Moore says, explain that he was a Greenpeace scientist. But he was allowed into the bureau. You know, the guy in the bureau even helped him find all the statistics. And within a day, he'd really tracked the Russian whaling fleet's positions over the last 10 years, and they seemed to focus at a particular time of the year, always in the same place, which was only 50 miles off the Californian coast. So they knew that was the area that they had to go to. But, you know, that's a big area, and this is where the kind of mystics come into play.
Right. We'll tell this story because they're getting desperate. The question is, should they keep chasing the whalers, and someone has a copy of the I Ching. Carly Truman tells the story in this clip I want to play, but you want to set this up for it? This is the kind of, I guess this is the mystical part of the
yeah,
of the
I mean, there wasn't room in the film really to include the number of mystical parts. You know, part of this was also following a moon bow in the middle of the night, but you know, there's a lot of kind of myths around this particular bit of Greenpeace history. But, as a group, I mean, Bob particularly was really interested in the I Ching, which is this Chinese book of essentially kind of ways to... it's kind of a book of prophecies, a book of ways to live, which are determined by the throw of a set of coins. And I think they would regularly throw these coins when they had a dilemma, as giving a kind of new angle on the dilemma.
Carly Truman isn't sure what to make of it. Here's another clip from the film.
I have no idea what the I Ching is. I've never heard of this book. I've never seen it. But of course, it's a book of divination, right?
The Chinese word, which means approach, has a range of meanings.
I thought I have joined a ship of fools.
The ancient explanations in the Book of Changes give as its first meaning becoming great.
Hunter throws one that says success. It furthers one to cross the great waters. There are four hexagrams out of the 64 that have that, and it just means good fortune, supreme good fortune. He's thrilled. He thinks that we should go and keep chasing whales, right? Pat Moore threw it, and he gets a second one of the four hexagrams. David throws it, and he gets a third one. I'm saying, what the hell are you guys doing? What, you're going to consult some kind of oracle for this decision? And they said, you throw them. And I went, oh, yeah, right. You guys, this is BS. And I threw them, and I got the fourth one. And we went out, and the next day we found the Russians.
The encounters, of course, with the Russian whaling fleet, this is some of the most dramatic footage and stories, really, from the film. And there's a moment that features Paul Watson. Let's say something about Paul Watson, though. I think he was one of the only ones I was really that familiar with, of course, because he was on this reality show where he is chasing down Japanese whaling fleets. He's, he's the most kind of infamous or famous figure, I think, in Greenpeace, or formerly of Greenpeace anyway.
Yeah, I mean, now since 79, he's been in his own organization, Sea Shepherd, which is the organization that's the center of Whale Wars, the Animal Planet show. And yeah, absolutely. He, I suppose, is someone who believes in direct action. You know, he believes that if you you need to confront people that are damaging the planet with aggression. I mean, Paul has never injured anyone. He's never but he has no problem with kind of rearranging molecules as Walrus calls property destruction. But yeah, he's this kind of at one end of the spectrum in terms of the group. He's the one who wants least compromise, who is most determined just to see things through to their end. And I think that moment during the first World campaign was really also a real turning moment for him.
Well, he's there on one of these floating dead whales, a baby whale, really. And he's stroking it. I mean, it's a really powerful image, but... But even the words, I think, from How to Change the World are pretty affecting. Here's a clip.
Stand up, Paul.
I was very much appalled by what I saw. Here we are, out here, they're killing these beautifully intelligent, socially complex, sentient beings. And for what? I actually got on to the whale to measure it. And I found it was illegally taken. It was an undersized whale.
What do you say, Paul? How long do you think it is? How long?
18 feet. That was certainly a turning point in my life. Just how warm the body was, how hot the blood was that was coming out of the wound. The whale's eye was open, and it just struck me in a flash that we're insane, ecologically insane. From that moment on, I never looked upon myself anymore as working for people, but more working for whales and other creatures that live in the oceans.
So Paul features, he's sort of this counter in many ways. As you said, he's the one who wants basically no compromise. And the next project that they get involved with, of course, involves protecting harbor seals from Canadian hunters who want their fur. And there's this... it seems like this is a really important element of the ongoing environmental movement right now. And I wanted to get you to talk about this. You know, the question is, how much ground do you give? How much do you compromise? How much do you account for humans in the scheme of things? I mean, these were Canadian hunters who made a living, and so they go to this Canadian town and have this confrontation. And there's this conflict, and on one hand you have Paul Watson, and Bob's on the other. Bob is willing to compromise, willing to take sort of humans and put them into the equation. And I'm wondering if you're seeing that going on broadly in the environmental movement, this particular one. How much should we budge?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really good example, because I mean, what a happened there was that Paul had come up with the idea of confronting the harp seal hunt in Canada. The method he was suggesting was that they spray paint, a dye, on the pelts of the baby seals. There's only a sort of 3-4 week period in which the pelts are valuable to the hunters, and that's when they're white and before they turn grey. And what happened at the time, and actually still happens, is that hunters would go into on the ice floes where there were large numbers of nursing baby seals, and kind of, you know, there's very dramatic footage in the film of these baby seals being bludgeoned to death for their pelts. When they arrive in St. Anthony in Newfoundland, they're confronted by, you know, for the first time, Greenpeace is confronted by a demonstration against Greenpeace, you know, which is a demonstration that really wants to run them out of town. And they want to run them out of town because this is a group of people who are right on the margins. You know, there's very low employment. They're in a kind of an economic crisis in that region, and the seal hunt is one of the things that you know, from which they earn money. And also, I think there was a symbolic thing for them about, you know, these guys coming from, these hippies coming from Vancouver and telling us how to live our lives. And I think Bob realized that the campaign would come to a halt at that point without some kind of negotiation. And he very kind of cleverly and strategically kind of tried to turn the issue around a bit from being about the local seal hunt to being about, again, you know, the industrialization of that hunt, the way in which large Norwegian sealing boats were coming into the flows and you know, harvesting far more baby seals than were done by the local landsmen. Paul, I think, would have taken the view that, you know, one seal is too many. Yeah. So I think for Bob, that if you wanted to look at what the difference of opinion there was, I think for Bob it's about media, it's about getting an image out to the world to draw their attention to this thing and then to try and build sort of legislation that will change it. For Paul, it's about direct intervention to stop the death of that seal, baby seal in front of you. And that's just that, you know, that's a different approach. I mean, I think as Rex says, and I'm not sure whether I cut it out of the film or whether it's still there, but, you know, that he believes in a kind of ecology of ecologists, you know, and that actually you need both those sides of things. They may not agree with each other, but you need both that direct, uncompromising approach, I think, to draw a line, and you need something which is in a way more complex and strategic to try and find solutions.
But, you know, this is the sort of the point in the story when Paul Watson starts to go rogue, basically. I mean, he doesn't really consult with Greenpeace generally, just wants to go ahead and do these operations anyway. And the idea, Bob says, look, let's go out to these ice floes, and even though we're not going to paint these harp seals with dye, we'll bear witness, going back to that, you know, that Quaker word, let's bear witness. But Paul isn't really having it. I mean, and you'll hear in this clip Patrick Moore of Greenpeace and Paul Watson, the sort of give and take of that idea of whether it works to bear witness. Here's another clip from How to Change the World.
I think we succeeded in getting our message out just as well as we would have if we'd sprayed them with green dye. Bearing witness is a powerful concept. Making it clear that you are watching it happen.
You don't walk down the street and see a woman being raped and stand there and take pictures. Bearing witness to me is cowardice. It's a non-intervention. I never understood it. We should not be submissive to these people who are destroying the planet. We should be aggressive. We should stand up and stand tall and get in their face.
So there are these rules throughout the film. Put your body where your mouth is. What's the first rule? It's plant the mind bomb. Yeah. Rule number four is the revolution will not be organized. And this is sort of what happens. I mean, Greenpeace starts to unravel. They have the Greenpeace Vancouver starts to sue Greenpeace San Francisco. There are these conflicts. There are these more infighting, and I wonder what that sort of says, because Bob becomes a wreck, you know, emotionally and physically. I mean, things are really starting to unwind.
I think as the organization grows, this dilemma of is it a movement? Are they trying to set off a kind of cultural shift, or are they trying to set off an effective set of organizations or a centrally controlled global organization? That disagreement becomes, you know, fundamental to the people involved. And Paul Watson is someone who has no real, doesn't feel the loyalty to the organization. His loyalty, as he says earlier there, is to the whales and to the seals and to the movement. And that's difficult for organizations because, you know, they have someone who's not really going to take the organizational priorities very seriously, but is, you know, is much more keen on making sure the action happens.
Well, it's Carly Truman who says in the film, she raises this question of the people who are the activists are not the ones who do the organizing. They're different types.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think those are different skills. And I suppose there's a kind of clear, for those of us sitting comfortably outside this, you know, there's a very clear need for organizations. But if organizations become self-serving, then that damages the movement. You know, so I think there's a real issue there, but it's a dynamic. But it's a much easier view to hold when you're sitting outside it than when you're in those intense arguments on the galley of a boat or, you know, in a group that's fighting that out.
Let me play one more clip. This is Paul Watson and Rex Weiland. Is it Weiland?
Weiland.
And Rex Weiland. And it raises a question that I wanted to get you to respond to after we hear this, and that is, having worked on this film now, do you get a sense of whether or not Greenpeace, this massive organization now, is better now, is stronger now, is more influential now? Or was it better when it was this ragtag group? I mean, Paul Watson doubts it's better. Here's another clip.
The important part of that period was the realization that a small group of individuals can make an impact, and that they could do it without many resources. I believe that Greenpeace was more powerful when it had nothing than it is today with its hundreds of millions of dollars.
I'm very proud of Greenpeace. The real ecology movement is a long, multi-generational phenomenon. It's really a lesson that nature is going to teach humanity, and we're just trying to help it along.
What do you think?
Well, when the quote from Bob, "The revolution would not be organized," comes from a book that he wrote before all this, actually, where he's looking at change, and he says that... I think the full quote is the revolution will neither be organized nor led. And the reason for that is that revolutions come at moments when there's much bigger kind of cultural shifts going on. And you just kind of play your part in that and you organize as part of that. And I mean, my view is that it's incredibly important for the world that there is an organization like Greenpeace that has the power to lobby at an international conference on climate change and has the ear of governments, you know. But it's also incredibly important that there are groups of hippies in small boats who are looking to the next, whatever the next thing is, you know, because Greenpeace is part of the establishment, actually. And whatever the next change is that need to happen are going to be things that are seen by young people, smaller groups, people who are kind of growing up in a very new culture. And I think we're at one of those real shift points at the moment. You know, people are very clearly unhappy with the old ways, you know, as they were in the late 60s, and I think that shift is going to come from, obviously, from the young.
It's Jerry Rothwell, director of the 2015 Sundance Film Festival opening night documentary, How to Change the World. We should say there are wait lists for the screenings throughout the festival, though you can get more information on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Jerry Rothwell, thank you very much for the
time.
Thank you.
Great.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to the Alf Engen Ski Museum at the Utah Olympic Park, to Connie Nelson, to Joe Oshnak, and Jared Goff. Thanks also to Geraldine Dreyfus and her team at Impact Partners. Radio West's intern is Braden Child. Our engineer is Lewis Downey, who directed the broadcast. Radio West is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.